If you will turn to Luke chapter 15, I will try to convince you what we have always taken to be a happy story is in fact the darkest story that Jesus ever told. The story that we incorrectly label the prodigal son. And I got to tell you, I have been extremely slow about coming around to, I think, hearing this parable. I got a chance to do something recently I had never done before. I got to go to a tool shower. Let me see your hands if you've been to a tool shower. Okay, a few of you have. My graduate assistant was getting married. His fiance had had one wonderful shower after another, and so his buds decided he needed to have a shower too, so they threw a tool shower. He registered at Home Depot. Well, that's important. You don't want to get, 10 of the same kind of wrench, right? Well, we all got him a tool, and here I attended this tool shower with this bunch of college guys. Now, a tool shower is a little different from your regular shower. One of the ways it differs is in the way you open presents. At a regular shower, what you do is you open each present one by one, pass it around the circle so everyone can hold it and say, At a tool shower, you open it up and say, that's a wrench, and toss it down. So, 10 minutes into this festive occasion, all the presents were opened. And of course, the burning question on my mind at this point was, what do you do at a tool shower after all the presents are opened? Now, one of the things I do need to say, that most of the bad things that have happened in my life have happened because of the company I keep, which are 18 to 22-year-old guys. So I was wondering, okay, what do you do for entertainment at a tool shower? I didn't have to wait long till the host told us what we were going to do. He says, okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to go around the circle, and everyone is going to describe their most disgusting illness or injury. And I got to tell you, this was highly entertaining. It's amazing the kind of things that can happen to guys. Well, here I am. I'm the only kind of old. That really wasn't the word I was. I was the only one with any maturity in the group. And I'm a bit of an academic. So unless I fall off my chair in the library, there's not much apt to happen to me. And so, I really got nothing to offer here. I was scratching my head. I couldn't really think of anything. I've been thinking ever since. And I think I don't have any good injuries. The only thing I could think of was, many of you know I'm the proud owner of two pugs. Well, I'm not all that proud, but anyway, why do you have two pugs? Because I didn't do good research, okay? And my first little pug was unusually stubborn, even for a pug. And so I sent him to obedience school. I went to get him after a week. The guy says he's not ready. I had to go back home. My dog got detention. I go back a few days later, and he says, okay, he's great now. He can do everything. He would heal, and he would sit. I couldn't get him to lay down. I'd say down. He'd just stare at me. And the guy says, no. You got to tell him like you mean it. You got to call him by name. You got to do the actions. And I said, all right, Proko, down. And I got a little excited, and I jammed my finger into the driveway we were standing on. My finger split, and now I have blood running down my arm. The dog trainer looks at me for 30 seconds and then says, and I thought the dog was slow. Uh-oh. Okay, so that's the proper introduction here, because I have been extremely slow understanding what's going on here. Let me tell you what I think's happening here. There are three stories here, and I think it's the last one that counts. Now, it's not like the first two don't, but the first two are essentially a setup for what Jesus really wants to say. So what we're going to do is we're going to read the first two stories, the setup stories, and then we're going to dwell on this very dark last story. that Jesus tells. First, the setup stories. 15:3. Luke. Did I say Luke? That makes a difference. Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? When he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. And he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, search carefully until she finds it? When she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin." In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Now, these are happy stories. These are moving stories. And in fact, at a certain level, they're very profound stories. There are some Christian thinkers who've suggested that these parables give us the one distinctive idea about the Christian God. That is, the one that Christians call God goes out and searches for the lost. And every place else, it's human beings that have to do the searching. It's human beings that have to find God. But this presents us a picture of a God who actually goes out and searches for us. Now, doesn't that feel good? Here's God searching. And what I'm tempted to do is just start kind of regaling you with stories about the God who searches. Because here we are in the middle of Oklahoma. You know, many of us are members of small churches. How many of you are a member of a church that's 200 or fewer? Okay, that's most of you. And if you count the real Christians, it's smaller yet, right? And every once in a while, we get kind of so caught up in our little world that we lose sight of what's going on in the bigger world. I heard my friend Everett Hufford say some things recently that really moved me. He was just talking about what's happening in Christianity around the world. He was saying that in Africa, for instance, in the year 1900, approximately 7 to 9% of the population was Christian. Today, that number is probably somewhere in the area of 46%. In one century, half of the continent of Africa has moved towards Christianity. There are more African Christians than there are North American Christians. Africans are now leaving their countries and going to other countries in Africa to evangelize. We're probably within a generation or two of having African missionaries come here. I've actually met a couple in this country, Africans who've come over here to evangelize because they see North America as such a mission point. God is seeking and finding. That gets you excited. What's going on in Asia is even more amazing in some ways. Take China, for instance. Conservative estimates said that somewhere in around 1900, that approximately 0.5% of the population of China would have claimed to be Christian. That's not 50%, that's 0.5%. Those decimals make a difference. Today, the most conservative estimate says that in China, 7% of the population claim to be Christian. And you're thinking, well, I'm not impressed with that. That's 7%. We're talking about China here. There are more Chinese Christians than there are American Christians. For 100 years, the communists in China have been trying to destroy religion, and there is a flourishing house church movement in China that is unbelievable. They don't have any churches. They don't have any steeples. What they've got is an underground church movement, some of which have 100,000 members. They talk in code language so they don't get caught. They'll send out messages saying, we're going to have a birthday party. Can you translate? That's a baptism. Pretty cool, huh? We have a guy at ACU whose wife is in our marriage and family therapy program. He's from Hong Kong. He goes into China regularly. He tells us that there are 100,000 Chinese missionaries ready to go across the world when the borders are open. And they've got this really weird theology. I love weird theology. I live for it. And they say, look, the gospel came from Jerusalem. The gospel needs to go to Jerusalem. So they're going to leave China and they're going to head for Jerusalem. Now, I don't know how your geography is, but what that's going to do is take them right across Muslim countries. Do you hear how twisted this is? You talk about Frankenstein. God is going to evangelize Muslim countries with Chinese missionaries. Blessed be the name of the Lord. God is seeking and finding. And Everett, who can be kind of funny, says he's even helping us out here in North America. We have been so reluctant to evangelize our neighbors to the south that God in his sovereignty has declared we do not have to go. He will bring them all to us. And so, you know, you don't have to go anywhere. All you got to do is learn the language. Okay, all I want to do is just inspire you for a moment with the truth of what this passage says. God seeks and he finds. And he's doing it all over the world. And I'm sorely tempted to sit down for about 10 minutes and just let people come to the microphone and say, I was lost and now I'm found. Because we just don't have to look around the world. All we have to do is look around the room and see lives rescued by God's gracious love. And my life would be so happy. And I would sleep so well tonight if that had been the last story. But Jesus has this annoying habit of telling you one more story than you want to hear. So he doesn't stop. He tells one more story. A different story. A dark and disturbing story. Verse 11. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him, ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. Now, I could live with this story very well if it would quit there. You probably notice that when you get to that point in the story, it is essentially the same story that we've already heard. It's still about the God who runs out and greets and seeks and rescues. There is one little difference in this story and the other stories up to this. The big difference is, I suppose, the manner in which the lost gets lost. I don't know how the sheep got lost. I assume it didn't have anything to do with the perverse nature of the sheep. I don't know anything about sheep, but I understand that they're not the brightest bulb on the Christmas tree. They're a little slow, and I assume the sheep got lost because it was on the dumb side. I don't know how the coin got lost. I assume the coin was not responsible for its own lostness, even though I have been known to blame inanimate objects for their lostness. Where did you go? I always love it when people say, you know, I was looking and looking for something and I finally found it. You know where it was? The last place I looked. Have you ever thought about how dumb that is? Whenever you're looking for something, it's always the last place you look. When you find it, you usually quit looking. Now, if you find it and keep looking, get help. Okay. But the Son is lost in a different manner. The Son is responsible for His own lostness. He's self-centered. He's selfish. He's wicked. He's perverse. He's sinful. So in some ways, this story makes the same point as the earlier stories, but makes it an even more deep and profound way, because God not only watches for stupid sheep, He also looks for perverse sons. I'm feeling good about life. But the story keeps going. And Jesus then introduces a totally unnecessary character to this story. This dark and sinister character, the older brother. Now, since this story pretty much sounds like the first two stories, and Jesus doesn't stop there but keeps going and then introduces a character we don't really need, my theory is this. This character is what the whole story is about. This is not about a lost son. This is about an older brother. Verse 25. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing, so he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. The older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. My son, the father said, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Now, what's that part of the story doing? At one level, it's pretty obvious. Look back at the beginning of chapter 15 and let's find out why Jesus is telling these stories in the first place. In these first two verses, we read how the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him, but the Pharisees and teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So you have this group of opponents of Jesus who are complaining about the company he keeps. So he then starts to tell them stories, and in the last story, he writes them into the story. It's clear these Pharisees are playing the role of the older brother. Here's Jesus trying to bring all these people in, and they're complaining about it. And so he tells them a little story, and he lets them play a role. He writes them in as the older brother. Now, Jesus often does kind of cool things like that, and I appreciate it. But what I don't appreciate is that while Jesus was writing them into the story, he wrote me into it too. And that I got a problem with. Because you see, when I read this story, I want to read it from a certain perspective. I want to read it as if I were the prodigal. But the problem is, I'm not. I didn't have a prodigal son experience. You know, my dad is here. My parents were very strict. I wasn't allowed to sin. Prodigal son experience, that was just out of the question. I'm the older brother. I'm the one who has been in church all these years, serving, slaving, working hard, making church a fit place for people to be. I'm the older brother. And I can appreciate his point of view. I mean, here he has all these years been slaving away, and then this guy comes sliding in, and God throws open the doors, and they have this big party. How could you not be a little resentful? I mean, I'm with him. Wouldn't you want to say, I've been working all these years to make church a fit place for people to be. I've been teaching in the Bible class, and I've been a small group leader, and I've been a deacon, and I've been an elder, and this punk comes home, and you want me to slide to the side and make room for him? To which Jesus' response is, okay, you're a little slow. That's exactly what I'm saying. And how we respond to this dark story of Jesus will in large measure determine the future of the church. Your church. All churches. The church. Are we the group of people who will be willing to party with the prodigal? Leonard Sweet's been doing some lecturing here this week. I don't know if you've noticed, he's great with a line. Those of you who've been able to hear him. And he's got one of my favorites. I sure hope he didn't use it this week. He says, the church loves blue hair. As long as it's not on a 16-year-old kid. Who looks like he's just crawled out of a tackle box. And we're not so sure. Okay, so here's the question in front of us. Are we going to be the church that says we're going to go everywhere, we're going to welcome everybody, and we're going to say, come in because we want a party? Or are we going to try to protect our position and the precious structures of church that we have so hard worked to build? Because when you welcome the prodigal home, you not only have a party, but you mess up your church. And how we respond to this is going to determine whether we have any future or not. In one of my earlier lives, I used to do worship seminars for churches. I hardly ever do this anymore. One of the reasons is that I found whenever I would usually go to a church that was embroiled in the worship wars. I'm sure none of your churches have ever had this experience, but some have. And they'd be kind of fighting over mostly what they're going to sing. And I would go in and do a seminar, try to teach them the real basis of worship, try to get them all together. And the reason I don't do this so much anymore is whenever I would do this, things would always get worse. I have come to understand why that is. It is because many churches are held together solely by lack of communication. When you clear that up, you have really got some issues. So when I'd go in, they'd have suspicions. When I got them talking, they were all confirmed, you know, and so it would get worse. And when I would do one of these worship seminars, I would usually end them up the same way. Usually we'd wind up on Sunday morning. By then, great tension in the air. I didn't create this tension. It was there when I got there, okay? And I'd always do the same thing. I would recruit the song leader beforehand. I'd say, okay, this is what I want you to do. I want you to lead three songs about roughly the same topic. I want one of them to be a classic Christian hymn. I want one of them to be a contemporary song. And I want one of them to be a Stamps Baxter oompah thing. Okay. And I said, I want you to lead all of these songs with equal conviction. And I'd always have to threaten them because, you know, worship leaders have got this way of kind of prejudicing the case. And I'd get up and I'd say, okay, this is what we're getting ready to do. We're getting ready to sing these three songs. And what we are going to do when we are done, right here in the church with our eyes wide open, we are going to vote on which one we like the best. We'd sing all three songs and then we'd vote. And it didn't quite break down into a third, a third, and a third. Pretty close. The classic hymn was always a little less than a third. There are very few of us that have really good taste in church music. But it got pretty close to being a third, a third, a third. And I'd say, okay, first of all, you know what it's like to be a song leader in this congregation. Do I have any song leaders here? I'm just wondering. Raise your hand. Okay. No matter what you're leading, two-thirds of the people wish you were singing something else. But I said, the big thing is this. The question you have to answer is, do you care more about the people who had their hand up when you didn't than you do about your taste in church music? Because that's about what it comes down to. Which do you care about most? Then I'd go, and a month later they'd split. And if I were still doing that sort of thing, if I were still doing worship seminars, I'd still do that sort of thing. But I'd want to say one more thing, too. I'd want to say, do you hear how narrow this conversation is? I hope next time I'm here, you're talking about something else. I hope next time I'm here, the question is not Amazing Grace or There's a Stirring. I hope you're talking about rap and punk and grungy, gungy gill. Because I hope you filled your building with those kind of folks who are going to bring their music in with them to be redeemed by God. You know, we've talked a lot about diversity in the church, but so far we haven't had any. I mean, what passes for diversity in our churches is variations on a theme, not diversity. And when we start reaching, there are whole segments of American culture which are almost untouched by the gospel of Christ. And when we get serious about taking the gospel there, what's going to come out on the other side isn't going to look exactly like you and me. And we're going to have to make the decision whether we're going to be like the older brother and say, we don't like the way that looks, or whether we're going to say, those are the people for whom Christ died. Come in, we got a party. And how we react to that is going to pretty much determine the future of the church. And I can tell you, this will be the hardest thing you've ever done. As people bring their broken, twisted, malformed lives to be redeemed by Jesus, and they mess everything up. I know Jesus wants them there. The question is, do we? And I got to give you a word of warning. If you get out there on this mission of Jesus, no one will be able to control the outcome. Only God will be in control. He likes to drive. And if you're one of those people who've got to have it all under control and got to keep your arms around it, got to keep a grip on it, you might as well not even start. Because we're going to do this. You're going to have to let it go. Say, come on. Let's party. So I was telling you earlier, most of the bad things that happened to me because of the company I keep. I was with a bunch of college guys in Thailand. We had just done some church work. We were going to do some more church work. And they said, hey, we're driving right past the jungle bungee jump. Wouldn't you like to bungee jump? I said, sure. Lying. So here we are in Thailand at the jungle bungee jump. A couple of them go. Now it's my turn. 50 meters high. For those of you who are Americans, that's 150 feet. It didn't look that high from the bottom. When you're at the top, it's like you're looking through wisps of cloud. And wouldn't you know, the most insecure member of our party, the old guy, has helping him a Thai guy who wishes to be a comedian. He ties the bungee around my ankles, and as he's doing it, he says the following. Does that look right to you? And I said, what? And he says, I can never remember how to do that part. I am now up at the top of the tower with the bungee around my ankles. I waddle up to the edge. Have my toes hanging off this 150 foot tower. And I'm having a little trouble breathing. My heart is pounding. I'm thinking, I can't do this. And then I look at those college guys down there, and I think, I've got to do this. If I do not jump off this tower, my life will not be worth living anyway. I got to jump. So I start to talk to myself. I said, Okay. When I become afraid, I'm very articulate. But my little Thai helper behind me says, head first. I said, what? He's head first. Okay, I get it. I got the bungee tied on my ankles. I can't just jump off here. I'll get yanked around. I got to dive. Okay, so I had a response to that. I said, okay. He could tell we had a little delay in the action. He says, I will count to three and you jump. And I said, 30. He says, I cannot count to 30 in English. And I said, I shall wait for you to learn. He says, three. I said, okay. He counts one, two, three, and I dive. And it is a rush. I mean, just free falling. How many of you bungee jump? Should I have some bungee jumpers? Okay. Unfortunately, they are all deceased. Yes, yes. I went to a church once. I was giving them this bit. I said, anybody bungee jump in here? There's only one guy in the room that bungee jumped. It was one of the elders. And I thought, what is wrong with this picture? You know, your leadership's jumping off towers. And then you're out the bottom, kind of bouncing up and down, looking at the world upside down. And it is a rush. I mean, it's just indescribable. Not that I'm ever doing it again. The point of my silly little story is this. You don't jump unless you believe at some fundamental level the bungee's going to hold. And what I want to say to you is this. If you take off on this dangerous mission of God, seeking those He seeks, loving those He loves, welcoming those in who are going to mess up your church, this is what I want you to hear. God's gotcha. You don't have to be in control. He is. He's got you. And when the church enters into the mission of God, God holds us tight. And all the worst things we think are going to happen are going to happen. And guess what? It's going to be all right. Because God's got us. It's hard for us to love a punk. I got to tell you, one of the things that distresses me about the churches I'm in is that they are frighteningly wholesome looking. And in much of our mission strategy, we are still thinking about how do we build a church that people like us who currently aren't going will go to. And I don't mind that. But there is a finite number of people who are going to come to church. The real question is, how do you take church to people who never walk in the building? And how do you reach those pieces of culture that are almost outside of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Oh, I got this dream. It is the craziest dream. I got this dream of two blue-haired people sitting in church together. She's 80, he's 16. Her hair's blue because she can't help it. His is blue because they didn't have purple that week. I got this dream. Two bald guys sitting there side by side. I'm one. The other guy's an 18-year-old skinhead who doesn't know you don't have to do that. It'll just happen if you wait. I got this dream of two people driving to church. One of them's car is rocking because they're doing the rap thing. And the other one is sitting in their car thinking no one's looking and they're conducting. Because they're listening to Brahms, and that's what people do who listen to classical music. When they think no one's watching, they conduct. And these people sit side by side in church, and they have absolutely nothing in common except the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Come on. God's got us. Most of the people in this room are closer to being dead than being born. We're on the downside. Come on. Let's go out blazing. Not protecting the church, but getting out there on God's mission and letting Him protect His own church. Come on. It all comes down to where we're going to stand outside and complain about the people who are messing up our church. Or where we're going to say, that which was lost is found. Let's party. Let's pray. Oh God, You are our God. We earnestly seek You as thirsty people in the desert who search and long for water. Father, with trembling hearts, we thank You for this dark story. I pray that You will forgive us for so often occupying a role in the story that's not really ours. And more importantly, I pray that You will forgive us when we've been the older brother. But I thank You for the mission You've given us that's bigger than ourselves. And I pray that You will give us the heart and the eyes of Jesus who sees in every person one who can be redeemed by God's grace. I pray we'll throw open the doors. Reach to the lost and join You in Your grand party. Through Christ our Lord. Amen.